Hello and welcome to this month's episode of We're Drunk and We Know Things. I'm Rob Dudley and I'm joined by Mike Dean.
Hello. Could I sound less disinterested there?
God, it's this again. A sentiment shared by many of our listeners, all three of them. In this month's movie segment, we're covering off John Carpenter's classic Escape from New York.
Classic in italics, underlined with, like, speech marks around it.
All of the asterisks.
All of the asterisks.
That's what I do. I drink. And I know things.
So yes, we're talking about So Stop Saying So Yes, because that's part of the drinking game.
That's the drinking game phrase.
So yes, and me saying amazing.
Enjoy.
Amazing, so yes, so yes, so yes, so yes, so yes, so but yes, but yes, but yes, amazing, 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 amazing. Enjoy your hangover. What was it saying? What are we doing? Why are we here?
Escape from New York.
Right, yeah.
We're escaping.
So, the movie we're doing this month, yes, is Escape from New York, which I was very positive about last month. Probably because I drank so much beer, and don't remember having watched it previously. So I rewatched it, and I did enjoy it, and I get it, and it was good. But I have issues, which is convenient because I've got a bit of a forum. I've got issues with the film, which is good because I've got a bit of a forum to discuss them. But yeah, I mean, I think we agree there.
To quantify, I love John Carpenter. He can do no wrong in my eyes. The man is pretty much movie god.
I agree. I like Ghost of Mars.
But yeah, I think as we'll discover as we go through this rambling review of Escape from New York, that we both ran into problems.
I think I just built it up in my mind, I think. Because you're like, Snake Plissken! And then you're like, oh.
Okay, so for those of our listeners who haven't watched Escape from New York yet, because of course they're immediately going to, what's it about?
The Isle of Manhattan has become a prison island in 1982, I think it is. The film was released in 1981, so it was like a year later.
1990s, actually, by the time they get around to it.
Yes, so it's 1997 in the film, isn't it? But it's set in the future. So the island of Manhattan has become a prison island, and it's walled off. They built a great big wall, and terrorists protesting this hijack Air Force One and crash it into Manhattan and take Donald Pleasance, who is the president, hostage. Snake Plissken, played by Kurt Russell, who is like some just uber badass, famous war hero, also seemingly the world's most famous criminal, who everyone thinks is dead, to much hilarity throughout the film, is recruited. He's being sent into the prison because he's been arrested for bank robbery. He's recruited by the head of the prison to get back the president, and in doing so, he will get a full pardon. But this is complicated by the fact that they put tiny little explosive charges in his arteries in his neck, which will explode in 22 hours if he doesn't get the president back in time.
Because there's a time limit they have to get the president back
for a special accord, right? Like
a thing.
Yeah, like a treaty signing about, because the world is still, America's still at war with Russia and China and seemingly everyone, because of course they are. So he's sent in to get the president back. And then hilarity ensues. He meets a lot of colourful characters. He's got a bananas good cast, Ernest Borgnine, Harry Dean Stanton, Adrienne Barbeau, because obviously she's in it, because she was married to John Carpenter and is in all of those films until she's not married to him anymore. He meets lots of various characters. It's, what's his face? Isaac Hayes, the famous singer of Shaft, is the Duke.
The voice of Chef.
And the voice of Chef, yes, famous Scientologist. And he has to rescue the president, and does, basically, is the plot of the film. Long story short. But it takes a really, really long time to get anywhere, seemingly. But that's my problem, is the pacing. But I mean, that is the plot summary in a nutshell, isn't it?
I think there are a couple of things that, on watching, firstly, the backdrop is actually quite beautifully set up, this idea that it's a country at war,
yeah,
and it's at war with everybody. It's very clear that the America that this is set in is not a happy place.
Yeah, it's very much dystopia. It's one of those things where it's one of those movies which is like, on paper, is just money. It's just like, it sounds so amazing. And then, like I say, I mean, I don't mean to just slate it because I did really enjoy it, but it's just pacing, man. It takes like 40 minutes for him to get to the island. He's escaping from the place and it takes him like 35 minutes to get there. It just, anyway. But
I'd also like to tip my hat to Donald Pleasance as the least likely member of the President's Club ever.
But he's English. apparently, he made up a whole backstory about how he could be president, even though he's English. And John Carpenter was like, "Shut up, man! If people are going to have problems with the plot of this film, it's not that you're English." Which is a fair cop, to be fair. I really love the egg thing that he escapes, the escape hatch, the escape pod thing he escapes from in Air Force One. He has like a really forced line when he gets into the escape pod about like, "May God smile on you and also me. You're all going to die."
I think this is the thing, is he's incredibly selfish and self-involved as a character. Yeah. You don't like him. You're not meant to, which is why Donald Pleasance is perfect, because he's fundamentally unlikable.
Sure.
The whole line when they're going down, is, "May God save me. Oh, and by the way, hope you're okay as well in this crashing plane."
Like I say, I don't know how much more of a plot summary we need to do, because I would assume that people are pretty familiar with this.
Yeah.
So I think that covers off like the plot summary. I assume that people are pretty familiar with Escape from New York. I mean, everybody is. It's pretty iconic. But that's certainly part of, moving on to the production, certainly part of that is like, it was written by John Carpenter. It was the first script he wrote before he even wrote Halloween, and it was written just after Watergate, when it was like a big distrust of the government and that kind of stuff was at its height. Then, you know, I know it's been 40 million cycles since then, but so that's why like the president is kind of a self-involved douchebag, which is a throwaway line at the end when Kurt Russell says, "Well, what about all the people that died to get you out here?" And he's like, yeah, they'll totally be remembered. They were awesome and whatever. So as I say, it was written as his first script before he even wrote Halloween. He made Halloween. It was an enormous success. He made it for no money whatsoever. So they gave him a two-picture deal. The studio gave him a two-picture deal. He made The Fog, which we can all agree, zombie pirates, amazingness. And then he made this. He was going to make Philadelphia Experiment, which is about invisibility or something. Didn't get off the ground. He famously said, I've got a script in my trunk, which is this movie. It was apparently much darker. And he got his friend Nick Castle, who is the guy that plays the Shape in Halloween. So, you know, Michael Myers. Mm-hmm. He got that bloke to do a pass on the script to add humour, weirdly. Yeah. I suppose you get Mike Myers to do a pass on humour. Just pausing for you all to finish laughing. And he added Cabby and the ending, you know, with the tape and everything. He's given him the big band tape and whatever, because that was super cool. And yeah, they said, okay, go for it. They gave him something stupid, like 500 times the budget of what he had for Halloween. And they made this movie. They wanted Bronson or Tommy Lee Jones or somebody to play Snake Plissken. He pushed for Kurt Russell because he'd met him during the making of Elvis. And I think we can agree, I mean, that's the reason this movie's so iconic and beloved, right? It's because Snake Plissken is a fucking badass.
Firstly, an amazing character.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Who we'll circle back to, I'm sure.
Yeah,
Also, the beginning of... It's one of the most beloved bromances in cinema. Carpenter, Russell, sitting in a tree.
Yeah. F-I-L-M-I-N-G. Jesus Christ. He says that Kurt Russell is like... him if he were a handsome actor, and Kurt Russell says the same about him being a director, although these days Kurt Russell says that about Quentin Tarantino. That is a marriage made in heaven, isn't it? I mean, if you think about all the movies later, The Thing in particular, and They Live and all that kind of stuff. I mean, Kurt Russell is not in They Live, but they definitely are an extension of one another. I mean, it's really is perfect. So just a bit of background, the production of the movie is quite interesting, actually, which was lucky because the film... Anyway, they were looking for locations that looked like New York, or at least looked like New York at night, because obviously the film is shot for 2 months at night the whole time. Nobody saw daylight for 2 months. And they found this town, called East St. Louis, whatever... that was basically destroyed by a fire in 1976, and it was America in the 70s. They didn't have any money, so they just didn't rebuild the place, so it was just derelict. So they filmed in this place, they dressed it up to look like New York, and they filmed in this derelict, burnt-down city for 8 weeks. Carpenter convinced the city to turn off 10 blocks of the city at night, turn all the electric off so they could light it themselves. It's just crazy. The bridge, you know, the landmine bridge at the end of the movie, right? He bought that from the city for $1, so that if anybody actually got hurt, the city wouldn't be
culpable.
Exactly. And he sold it back to them for $1. So they essentially took over this completely like dead ghost town city, and from the sound of things, saved the place just by pouring money into it, basically.
I quite like the idea that, what do you think would have happened if John Carpenter had not sold the bridge back to them for a dollar? He'd be like, no, it's mine.
It'd be amazing, wouldn't it?
It's now the John Carpenter Bridge.
I'd love to buy a bridge and name it the Mike D. Memorial Bridge and be like, oh, how did he die? No, he didn't. He's just a dick.
Yeah, he's over there.
he operates the toll.
Off his bridge.
That'd be incredible.
So was none of it shot on location? Because let's put it this way, there are some amazing locations that are referenced in the film. You've got the Twin Towers at the very beginning and end, somewhere in the middle.
I'm so glad you asked this. This is so exciting.
Grand Central Station.
Yep.
You've got the New York City Library.
Yep.
And you see the full frontal libraries. That's what our listeners tune in for. So, go on. You're about to tell me that they made it all out of polystyrene and midgets. Little people.
We've covered this in C. Amazing. This is amazing. You've said this. So, Grand Central Station isn't. In East St. Louis, they've got a train station that was, like I say, vacant and derelict, which was modelled on Grand Central Station. So they filmed in there.
What are the odds?
Amazing, amazing. Best location manager of all time. The steps of the library is a backlot. Now, the Statue of Liberty scenes at the beginning, they are the first film company or film production to ever be allowed to shoot on Liberty Island at night. So they got permission to do that. So all of that is actually at the feet of the Statue of Liberty.
So this is the police, effectively the police headquarters.
It's like the entry to the prison is Liberty Island.
The helicopters and Hueys.
So they're the first film team to ever be allowed to film there, which was a really big deal. And apparently they had a bombing about 4 months before. So it was a really big deal and an absolute fucking nightmare to film. But, I mean, that is cool. I mean, that's the thing. My problem with this film is that the first 35 minutes drag like a motherfucker. It's all set up and setup's not good enough, but if you get permission to shoot in Liberty Island, I kind of get that that's a big deal, but yeah, I mean, it distracts. So the other locations, like you say, Liberty Station, that kind of stuff. What other locations did you say? Sorry, you said the steps of the...
Well, you've got the World Trade Center that you see as a backdrop.
This is amazing. So they either shot from across a river and they got establishing shots. All of the New York City skyline stuff in the background is matte paintings, or are matte paintings, I should say. And those matte paintings were done by one Mr. James Cameron.
No.
Yeah, so he worked for Roger Corman's production company. Look at that, I'm so pleased. I knew this was going to, are you going to like this? So he worked for Roger Corman's production company. I think it's New World Pictures, I think it was called. And he was lent to them and did some of the second unit director of photography stuff. But all of those matte paintings are hand painted by James Cameron. This is so cool. It's the coolest thing about this film. I was reading it and was like, it blew my mind. It's so cool. So there's loads of photos and stuff of him being on set and stuff, and he's just a member of the crew. But it's, I mean, that must have hurt him. James Cameron's got a bad ego. I should be directing this. There should be more guns and women flexing biceps.
I think, again, the mind boggles at what Escape from New York would have been directed by James Cameron.
So the other thing that is amazing, other than the James Cameron, the Jimmy Cams moment that I love so much, is that, you know when he's in the glider?
Yeah.
And he's flying into the city, and the computer is, like, scanning the city, and is that wireframe model of the city?
Yeah, if by the way, you like old-school, low-res CGI... yeah.
Then this is your masturbatory fantasy.
This is definitely one of your movies.
This is jerk-off material. This is Wang Bang stuff. I'm just making sure we get that 18 certificate. I'm making sure we get that E next to the podcast.
Oh, it's pretty much guaranteed at this point.
Yeah. So that wireframe, what's it, was super expensive in 1981 to do. So what they did was they built a scale model of the city and they put UV tape on all the edges and then they filmed it under a UV light. So it's not computer animated at all. It's just a camera like panning over the top of a model with a UV... It's stickers and wood.
It's amazing.
It's insane.
That's exactly what you need.
I've watched it since I read that. I've watched it again. And
can you see the wood?
You can't tell.
You can't see the wood.
You really, you know. And I'm believing, I'm always looking for words.
This is where people say that, you know, they just... Filmmakers these days they don't have to try, really. They've got all the CGI and the amount of effort.
And think how long that shot is, right? It's like a 40-second scene of, like, him...
they made the entire city out of wood... UV tape, and they just flew a camera through it.
I mean, that bit is one of the worst pieces of compositing since, like, the dove at the end of Blade Runner. So something has been brought to my attention by our producer Big Daddy Gooch this afternoon, actually, and apparently that that city model was repainted and used for the opening establishing shots of Blade Runner for the setting the scene in the city. Although Blade Runner, isn't that set in Los Angeles? Not New York.
It's a city to city to city.
Whatevs. But yeah, I mean, really? I just think the production of the film is so interesting. It really is. It's just like they just basically bought a city and then just used ingenuity like they always used to have to, you know.
I mean, this is the thing, is people say that these days filmmakers are spoiled, they can just do it all with CGI.
Yeah.
You know, back to the Lucases and what have you, and indeed the Carpenters. See what I did there? He made a city out of wood.
Nice.
Yeah. Anyway, having to actually just edit, build giant things.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
And then apparently sell them to Ridley Scott.
Well, you know, I've got two other little bits of trivia about the production. I think we should talk about like our feelings on the film, because I think that's the biggest part of this. Going to be this episode is about our feelings on this movie. But my two favourite bits of trivia are the voiceover at the very beginning.
Yes.
And there is no smoking on the line. Follow the orange line, you know, when he's in the prison. Yeah. That's Jamie Lee Curtis.
Doing the voice.
Uncredited, yeah. And amazing. She does the narration at the beginning. Now, when Adrienne Barbeau dies at the end, you know, it cuts back and you see her dead body lying on the hood
bleeding
of the car.
All over the place,
right? Bleeding all over the place. That shot was suggested by a teenage J.J. Abrams. J.J. Abrams' dad worked at the studio, and J.J. Abrams saw a rough cut of the movie, and was, because J.J. Abrams is like, well, he's today's Steven Spielberg, was just knocking around the studio, as one does, and he bumped into John Carpenter and said, do you know what your film needs? You don't really feel that she's dead. You don't get that she's died properly. I feel like you should cut back. So John Carpenter got the car from the movie, put it in his garage at home, where he lived with Adrienne Barbeau, because they were married, bloodied her up, laid her down on the hood of the car, and then shot a quick take, and then put it in the film. But that was J.J. Abrams' idea, which is weird because there's no camera flare. There's no camera flare at all.
I think it's starting to. We'll talk about
like the making of this movie is so much more interesting than the film itself.
Right, before we get on to why you're wrong. Have we switched
positions since the end of the last podcast? You were in love with this film now, and I'm out of love.
My problem with it at the end of the last podcast was, given the other options available to our
voting
listeners,
you just wanted to do Empire.
I wanted to do Empire Strikes Back. However, based on what we've got, but before we get into that, a John Carpenter film would not be complete without talking a little bit about the wonderful, wonderful soundtrack.
Oh, the synth. The magnificent synth. And the music is amazing in this film, to be fair. It really is good. You don't like it?
I think he hits the various thematic notes he's going for. But
like,
if anybody is listening to this and hasn't seen a John Carpenter movie, he was part of a group, a dodgy synth pop band, basically. And there are photos.
He just never got over how amazing synthesizers are.
There are photos out there of John Carpenter and his band. I can't remember what they were called. They did have a name, I think. But you look at the photos, and it's basically, this is the 70s and the 80s, so you've got a bunch of guys wearing a lot of denim, droopy mustaches.
Picture John Carpenter.
Yeah.
Now, that's how they dressed then.
Yeah, but a group of them. And the trouble is that whereas most filmmakers would be like, well, I enjoy music, I make music in my spare time.
Yeah.
Carpenter insists on, no, I am going to score my own movies.
I'm a musician! Okay, John. Well, apart from Ghost of Mars, because he gets Rammstein in to do that soundtrack.
Yeah. But
which we can all agree is,
it actually mostly works. I mean,
yeah,
it's synthy, it's bloopy. There are a couple of bits that I take umbrage at.
Yeah,
the aforementioned glider scene, where it's swooping and swooshing.
But the lighting of that scene is fantastic. When he's haloed by red and the green on the face, I think the lighting
absolutely.
Of that
when
is really
he gets
really
in
iconic.
And he's in the dark. And to be honest, we can talk a little bit about lighting as well, because there are a couple of moments which are superb.
Well, that's what happens when you buy a city and then tell them to turn the electric off and then can light a city how you want. It's the best. It's like a kid with a sandbox, isn't it? You do whatever you want. It's amazing.
But yeah, if you basically picture what would happen if you were obsessed with synthesizers and making a dramatic, tense, and dark movie, you can probably imagine what Carpenter ends up with for the soundtrack of this film.
I think it fits the film really well, and I like it's. I remember thinking at one point rewatching it for this, thinking, I feel like I could listen to this without the film. Like, you know, there are bits of it that I would listen to. And there aren't many soundtracks that I could just listen to without the film on because, you know, it's all very dependent on the action and the beats of the film and that kind of stuff. But there were a couple of bits of this soundtrack that I really was like, am I into synth now? Is that me? Do I need to wear like one of those piano key ties now? Do I need shoulder pads? And a flock of seagulls haircut? And a coke habit?
You start boring people about, you know, your current Valve synth acquisition.
Yeah, exactly.
And given over half a room in your house to building one.
We're drunk and we know synth. That could be our new offshoot podcast.
No.
And just like an hour discussion of synth.
No.
No?
No.
Fair enough.
So, Carpenter scoring. We spoke a bit earlier about lighting, and there are some amazing moments in terms of the way that the thing is lit. Mostly surrounding Snake Plissken, who is... to my mind,
super iconic, isn't
one
he?
Of the
I mean, he's given birth
characters.
To so many. He's like the, like, he's not the original anti-hero or anything, but he certainly defines it.
He's
and
a distillation, bizarrely, of so many other characters. I mean, James Dean's in there.
Clint Eastwood, very much. A lot of Clint Eastwood, yeah.
One of the things that I love about this film is that everybody knows him. He's literally just
he's like the most famous guy, isn't he?
Landed in a prison, but yeah, everybody knows who he is, and everybody thinks he's dead.
Well, that's
it's kind of a recurring theme throughout.
I mean, the prison warden
he meets.
Who is incredible. Who that guy filmed? I can't remember his name. Lee Von Cleef, is it?
Yeah.
He filmed all of his stuff in a day, and they had some scenes that they forgot to shoot, but he was too expensive to get back. But like that scene in the. That scene in the office where he like smokes a cigarette, he's wearing the tank off, call me Snake, all that kind of stuff. It's like, this shouldn't be as compelling as it is. It's just two dudes in a room. We've both heard of each other because we're both badass war heroes. And also he's like a famous bandit, and it's, I don't know, it's just effortlessly cool, isn't it? But that's all Kurt Russell.
I think it is, and it's bizarre because when you watch it, you almost, you're carried along by the other character's reaction to Snake Plissken. On the face of it...
Because you know nothing about him either.
Kurt Russell not actually that cool in this role.
He's a very
cool dude.
It's like the legend of him built up by all the other characters,
absolutely,
right? So like Cabby, I mean, Ernest Borgnine, who is bananas good in this movie, his reaction to being like, holy shit, you're Snake Plissken, it really makes you be like, oh man, you're... It's like, this is a big deal. I need to like this guy. Like,
yeah, I should totally know who this guy is, even though he was made up for this film, and I only met him for the first time 15 minutes ago.
Apparently, Kurt Russell had a thing where he, to test out the costume, whether this is true or not, it doesn't sound true, but it's a cool story anyway. He went out on the streets in East St. Louis, which, like I say, was all burnt down, very poor and stuff, and quite dangerous. And he just went out for a walk in the middle of the night, dressed as Snake Plissken, and just everybody just turned around and just walked immediately away from him. It might have been the fact that he was carrying a Tech 9 with a silencer. But apparently he said to John Carpenter, like, oh, we've got a hit on our hands. Like, well, maybe you're a dude in an eye patch with a machine gun. Maybe that was what it was. You could be dressed
standard,
in a clown suit.
Standard just, Friday night in St. Louis. Yeah.
Big Bird could walk down the street with a okay, let's just picture that. This is good.
Big Bird
with an eye patch and a Tech 9, and I'd run. Or I mean, I'd have a boner, but I'd run. That got a reaction from our producer there. He finally looked up from his phone to laugh at my I've got a boner for Big Bird joke. Thanks very much.
Release? Or have you got more production?
No, I'm done with production. No. So it was released in 1981. The only thing it was out against really was Superman 2, which can go fuck itself. We'll talk about it.
Well, I like Superman 2.
The Donner cut is far better. Don't be ridiculous.
Yeah, all right. But it
cost $6 million. Made 25 mil domestic. I, for the life of me, can't find out how much is made worldwide, because for some reason it's the only thing on the internet that isn't available, apparently. But it made 25 mil domestic, which is a crazy success, especially in 1980. And it just made Kurt Russell, who was a Disney star, don't forget, he was in MVP, mm-hmm. Most Value Primate. He was a Disney movie star before this, and this helped change his kind of his image into, like, you know, like the rugged workman kind of like blue collar hero guy. You know, he ended up, interesting enough, the you know, Chock Full of Nuts,
the cafe bit
with the woman that gets pulled down the shore, that's his wife at the time. I didn't know that he wasn't always married to Goldie Hawn.
Yes,
in
he,
my mind they
always
he
has a type.
Yeah. But this you know, this made him Kurt Russell, essentially, this film. It was lukewarm received. Shockingly, a lot of critics criticised the pacing of the film.
There is nothing wrong with the pacing in this movie.
Oh, well, yeah. And half an hour in, there's nothing wrong with the pacing. But for the first half an hour, it's slow as shit.
Right. Let's take a moment. Let's just talk about the pacing in this movie. Because I'm firmly of the belief that actually that first half an hour is incredibly important.
Oh, it's important, but I don't think you. I think you could do it in 20 minutes.
You could do it in 10, but why do in 10 what would take 30?
It's just too much establishing. There's too many establishing shots. There's too many long takes of the Statue of Liberty. There's too many, like, a bus pulling into a car park or, like, walking down a hallway for ages. Like, you could cut all of that. You could half it, and it would just feel tighter.
But it doesn't need to. That's the point.
But the film is called Escape from New York. No. You want him to get to New York in order to escape from it.
Okay, granted, yes. He doesn't actually start escaping until he gets in. But the point is, it's the contrast between the pace and the tension of life on the inside of the New York penitentiary
and
the complete lack of pace on the outside.
Yeah.
The fact that actually outside is...
Like, you'd much rather live in the prison, right? Like,
well,
than
you
would in the outside.
Shit going on. They've got chock for the nut shops and
exactly,
stuff.
You know. People living in the sewers.
But I
loads
I
of dudes dressed
actually,
up as women singing songs.
Granted, he could probably have shaved a few minutes off.
A few tens of minutes. No, I like
well,
I say...
And it also means that when you actually finally do get into New York, because this film is 93 minutes long...
Yeah, it's not long. It's not a long film, which is weird to have a pacing issue. It's an hour and a half.
An hour.
Yeah.
Of quite tense, because he's checking the countdown timer, how long have I got left.
Yeah, he drops the radio. And a lot happens in that hour.
Yeah.
A lot happens in
and
that
I think
hour.
You wouldn't actually appreciate that if he'd made it an hour and 10,
but
an hour and 20.
I think you could have given that hour an hour... I think you could give that hour an hour and 20 and have 15, 20 minutes of setup.
They kind of run out of stuff to do.
Yeah, they do run around a lot. They spend a lot of time in Cabby's cab. I love the foreshadowing of the tapes. That's my favourite thing. It's so good. Yeah. But no, I mean, like I say, I don't have a problem even with the performances or anything like that. It is what it is. It's a very cheesy 80s action movie. That would be like criticising Rowdy Roddy Piper in They Live. You know, it's stupid, you know. Like that 20-minute fight scene between him and Keith David in the alleyway for no reason. It is what it is. It's a film from 1981, but I just feel like the first half an hour drags, man. It really does.
Okay. Obviously, there is another escape from.
Yes. Well, I think we should have just done that one. It's amazing. I love the first one.
Now you tell me.
The second one is Escape from LA. It's just fucking stupid. I love it. So it was made like 18 years later or something?
Yeah, and has worse CGI than the non-CGI in the first one.
He surfs. I mean, Bruce Campbell's in it, so that's immediately a win in my book.
So does it have any other lasting legacy? I mean, we've spoken about, obviously, it established Kurt Russell, it established John Carpenter and
the first film.
The first film. But
well, I mean, yeah. I mean, like I say, the legacy of Snake Plissken is like... I mean, you wouldn't have Metal Gear Solids without...
No, because
Solid Snake is Snake Plissken.
an unapologetic homage.
And it's stuff like, you know, like Cloverfield, you know, the Statue of Liberty head getting thrown down the road?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that's an homage to the poster of Escape from New York, which doesn't happen in the film. You know, he stood there by the crumbled Statue of Liberty, you know? Which is so weird for me, because I always see that poster and I'm like, cool! And then you're like, oh, it's intact. So that's J.J. Abrams writing that into that film, which was directed by Matt Reeves, but it was him writing that in as an homage to one of his favourite movies. But I mean, yeah, I mean, the legacy really is, I just think, like, the badassness of Plissken and, like, the anti-hero kind of, you know... I mean, there was that movie... you ever seen that movie Lockout? The Luc Besson movie?
Yes, I have.
With Guy Pearce, which is a full-on, straight-up rip-off, to the point where that's the lawsuit. That's the lawsuit I was saying about earlier, off mic. John Carpenter was like, go fuck yourself, I'm suing you. And sued him. Sued Luc Besson, and they were like, yeah, cool, we'll give you $10,000. And he said no, so they appealed. And he got $500,000 off him in the end. Because
but that's 10,000 bridges.
Exactly. Well, he bought it for $1, so that's 500,000 bridges he could have bought.
The final settlement.
Yeah, amazing. But yeah, he sued Luc Besson, who, frankly, is getting to be more of a hack as the years go by, but we'll talk about that in a different episode, I'm sure. But
maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I actually quite like Lockout, but...
It was a good film, but you're right, it does...
It reeks of Escape from New York.
A little too
he has
much.
To go into a prison island that they've made of Manhattan. No, it's a prison
space
station
space.
To
it's
save the president's daughter.
To save the president's
daughter. The president's impossibly hot and impossibly skinny, president's daughter. So, I mean, other than that, for legacy, I mean, really, I think you just get on to movie recommendations, which are everything else by John Carpenter, I think, is better. But don't... Like, The Thing is The Thing, and The Thing is The Thing, man. The Thing is The Thing. It's amazing.
Watch The Thing. The original.
Yes. Don't... I mean, watch the sequel, but... Nope. It's not that bad.
No, don't bother.
Okay, fair enough. But don't just watch Halloween and Assault and 13 and Assault and Precinct 13 and stuff. The movies you should watch are In the Mouth of Madness and Prince of Darkness, which are my favourite John Carpenter movies. Prince of Darkness is Donald Pleasance, like, in a haunted house, takes, he's like a teacher that takes a bunch of kids into a house, and it turns out there's a tank full of green slime, which basically has the devil in it. But it's amazing. It is amazing. And In the Mouth of Madness, which is like a weird, it's essentially like a Stephen King story that John Carpenter kind of wrote, crossed with Lovecraft, with Sam Neill in it, Dr. Alan Grant himself. And that is, seriously, if you haven't seen In the Mouth of Madness, go and check that out, because that is John Carpenter's best.
And of course, it wouldn't be a fair review if you want to know the origin, or not the origin, the destination, in fact, where he ended up, of Kurt Russell, the ultimate anti-hero.
Being a sleeveless vest-wearing badass.
A white vest, including the moment when he shamelessly just removes his shirt
reason. I already know what you're going to say.
It's got to be Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah, I mean, that is... Like, when I was a kid, a very, very long time ago, not that long ago, I'm not that old, my parents, as a wedding present, going back even further, got a black and white TV, one of those twisty knobs you used to tune in, so you physically had to tune it, you know, to get the next channel, and we tuned it in one day, and my sister snuck into my room, and we were sitting up late watching a film, and we tuned it in, and Big Trouble in Little China started, right? We'd never heard of this film, but I was like, this bloke looks like a fucking badass. Because I was a camp gangster kid. That's exactly how I said it to my sister. He looks like a motherfucking badass. And I sent her to bed after half an hour because it got too scary. And as a big brother, I had to say, listen, I'm going to step in here. You're going to have to go to bed. But I stayed up and watched it. And then just shit my pants for about 3 months afterwards. Because I was like 7 and had watched Big Trouble in Little China and was a pussy.
You heard it here first, folks.
Lo Pan is...
Which Lo Pan? No, anyway.
Can't wait to get back round to B so we can do that again.
We could have done it.
We could have.
We could have done it instead of A.
Only we had a time machine. If you like...
Go on.
...a dark, synthy, kind of gothic feeling, kind of bleak, dystopian feeling movie...
Does it involve...
That also happens to star Dr. Alan Grant himself.
Yeah, being trapped somewhere...
Do you know what you should watch?
You
should watch Event Horizon. You should watch it. I urge our listeners to go and watch Event Horizon. If you like Big Trouble in Little China, it would definitely be up for it, because it has Chinese mystics in it. I'm just making shit up now, I don't care. I'll say whatever I have to.
It's got Kurt Russell in a vest.
I don't want people to think that I'm getting some kind of back end from Event Horizon Blu-ray sales, but if you buy it, I won't kill your dog. Have I gone too far that time? The producer steps away for 10 seconds.
We've found the line, apparently.
The producer steps away for 10 minutes, and I'm threatening to kill people's dogs. Okay, so... as much as we love this film, clearly, there are some Amazon one-star reviews, which is the best, so we should probably cue the jingle.
The movie is really great, but we all know haters gonna hate. We all know the film's alright, these crazy people think it's shite. From the depths of the internet we bring to you, it's Amazon One Star Reviews.
So there were a few, mostly it's because the Blu-ray shit, so it's like, Optimum releasing, go fuck itself. It doesn't say that, but it can.
I think one of them actually did.
Yeah, it's not great, they're not good. Harold C. Saunders from June 2016, entitled Not Worth Your Time. His review is just, really? This is his whole review, really?
Is there a really question mark, done.
Amazon customer, February 2017, what a joke. You don't get 8, you only get number 7. I think he's reviewing Fast and the Furious, and it's somehow he's ended up on this page. I don't know why. What a joke, you don't get 8, you only get 7. Do not buy. That's the title. The review is blank. So I think you might be on the wrong page.
There are a lot of confused people.
Ripley, a joke of a film, god awful. Which seems, I mean, I'm not the biggest fan, but I mean, that seems a bit harsh. Fell asleep watching, though the plot line was good, so I'll give it another shot. 1 star.
How do they know?
Weird. Don't know that one. This one is particularly good. Ooh, slam. There is a scene where the main character, who has a gun, watches a woman about to get raped, walks away, and then beats up a homeless man.
To be fair, that's there
more,
is a scene.
There is, I mean, but that's more of a plot summary than it. I'd like, that's the point, though, right? Like, that scene is in there for a reason. That's, yeah, we establish
that's
that Snake
Plissken, he's like, a complete bastard.
Yeah, one star. Anyway, Samar does not like it. He does not like that woman was about to get raped and he did nothing. Now, Brian Stork from May 2014 was a bit more scathing. He said, the worst plot, brackets, oh, there might have been one. The worst acting, brackets, and that's saying there might have been a microsecond of acting. He's confused whether or not there was anything. I almost retched, but I fell asleep. I almost retched, but I fell asleep. Listen, bro, I've been there. Seriously, I was there last night.
So close.
I almost retched. But I fell asleep. That's how my wife describes our wedding night. Oh, so good. I love it. And once again, these are culled from Amazon.com, because Amazon.co.uk is just the Blu-ray shit, or I didn't really like this. Very uninteresting.
I think this
God
is...
God bless America.
We need a call to arms for the British people.
Yeah.
Start being a bit more vitriolic in
Be
your
more outlandish
reviews.
Dickheads on Amazon, because, you know, I mean, I almost retched, but I fell asleep. The intonation is mine, but the sentiment is his. I mean, it's so good, so good.
So, in summary, Escape from New York, worth watching?
Mixed bag. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Definitely
but
watch
make
it.
Make sure you buy the DVD, not the Blu-ray.
Yeah, or just nick it off the internet.
Or just nick it off the internet, let's face it. I mean, Carpenter doesn't really need the money anymore.
I think I got a Blu-ray rip, and I watched it on my iPad, and it looked good. And then I've got the actual Blu-ray, so it's fine that I stole it off the internet. But I then watched the Blu-ray, and it didn't look as good on my big, high-def television. So, weird.
It is... dark
there are American
anyway.
Versions you can buy that are like remastered and stuff, but I mean, unless you're whatever Brian Stork was, I mean, he obviously got a shit version because he almost retched, but
fortunately dozed off.
I've never been sick when I watched a film, you know, like, I mean, I nearly walked out of Elektra, but I didn't make me want to be sick.
Human Centipede.
Oh well, yeah, that's true,
came close.
Yeah, so next time we'll be doing the polls are in. The votes are in. The people have cast
the polls
votes.
Are closed.
Polls have closed.
Democracy has worked its magic.
Yeah, and this time I actually like democracy, because next time we'll be doing Face Off, which is just one of the best films ever been made.
We're doing Face Off. The other choice, of course, being
French Connection or
French
Fight
Connection
Club.
Or Fight Club.
So Face Off is more fun. So I think that would be better.
Bear in mind that the votes tell us a lot about our listeners. And what they currently tell us is that they don't like good cinema.
I think they just tell us that you've got a shitload of Twitter accounts that you use for voting.
Hey, if it was up to me, the French Connection would have won. Best car chase in cinema history, hands down.
We're going to talk about Rorschach Schneider, we're going to talk about Jaws, though.
We are, So
Face Off next time.
Join us next month for Face Off. You have been listening to We're Drunk and We Know Things. This month's movie topic was Escape from New York, hosted by me, Rob Dudley, and Mike Dean, and produced by Big Daddy Gooch. You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/WDAWKT, on Facebook by searching WDAWKT, anywhere else on the internet.
You can also search We're Drunk and We Know Things on Facebook, because I changed
it. You can. Okay, fine.
I changed it.
We'll see you next month.
Bye! I love you.